All right. Good morning, Stephen. Thank you for the support. That is encouraging. I never got a chance to tell you. I think you're doing just an unbelievable job with the youth. Maybe because you clap for me. So I knew it was spring when I woke up this morning. I can tell you we're not going to have any more snow because I woke up and both nostrils just clogged, forehead pounding. That's why I brought up my friend. Although this is kind of, what is this about? Powerade Zero? Is that, I guess that's a new law. School has to do the zero thing. It doesn't help me out, but so that's going to help me today. Maybe keep the headache at a minimum so I can get through this for you. But it's spring. That's the negative of spring is you get this, allergies and, you got to deal with that for the next couple months. But what's the good thing about spring? Anybody? Yeah. Well, maybe this isn't a good thing this year. I don't know. We'll find out. So Cardinals have started. It's the opening week of the baseball season. Normally, I do not care. I like going to the games. I've always loved going to the games. It's a big event, big atmosphere. Love it. But I never really sit down and followed it. But I found myself the last 2 days sitting in front of my computer watching stats change and go up and down and keep clicking refresh because now I'm in a fantasy baseball league. And that's just how it works. I don't know if that makes me lame. But it's getting me into baseball. It's getting me excited about baseball. But the thing I've noticed leading up to this season is anyone can tell me what the biggest storyline is with the Cardinals right now? What about Pujols? Is he leaving or staying? Is he going to be a Cub next year, right? Are you going to see him in blue? Which would be ugly, like the Brett Favre and purple thing. It doesn't fit. It doesn't go right. And so who's at fault? Who thinks Pujols needs to ask less money? Okay. Who thinks the owners need to just pay up? Very few people. Okay. And this is good because if it was the other way around, this illustration would not work at all. So we're like, Pujols, dude, come on, just take a little less money, And I've heard some sports guys on the radio. They say, well, he's trying to set himself for life. Really, I think if he gets a contract over like $1 million, I think he's set for life. But that's kind of the language that gets thrown out there, and that doesn't translate to us, hardworking folk, and we're not getting the big $1 million contracts, we're not in the light. We don't like to see that. We don't like to hear, players and owners arguing over how much money's gonna, who's gonna get what money. Because they're both getting just, hand over fist money. It's crazy how much money they get. Like, we can't even conceive of having that type of money in our lifetime, let alone one season. And the same thing is true with the NFL lockout, which is near and dear to my heart, more so than this Pujols thing, which I definitely want to see Pujols here. It's going to break a lot of records. It's going to be great for our city. But the NFL lockout is troubling because, as many of you know, my Green Bay Packers won. I haven't had a chance to gloat about that yet, so I had to work this out in the sermon. Green Bay Packers won the Super Bowl, and they're going to not, there's a chance they're not going to play next year. These guys are front runners to win again, And what are they going to do? They're going to argue over who's going to get how much money. Are the owners going to get more money? Are the players going to get more money? Who thinks the NFL players should get more money? Everybody the same? Okay, so a few. Who thinks the owners are justified in making cuts? I'll go ahead and give you my assessment because I like to get you edgy and, cause conflict early in the sermon. My take on it is, every company is making cuts, everybody's making cuts, so the owners, it would make sense to me that if they say they're in debt, hey, that makes sense to me because all these other companies are cutting. Now, we can argue about that later because you don't have a mic, but that's my take on things. And as a group of people, we look at this and we say, I do not want to see this type of bickering over how much money someone's getting. I just want to see them play. I just want to enjoy the game. I want to see Pujols here. I don't care how it works out. Just make it happen, And we don't. We kind of, most of us look at the players, as we've seen by the consensus today, It's the players that usually we look at and say, you know, hey, you guys need to stop taking as much money. You know, you're playing a game. You know, you're playing a child's game for all this money. And we look at them and we say, greedy. We look at them and we say, I would never do that if I was, I would play for next to nothing. And we really kind of put ourselves in a position of being able to judge a situation that we will never be able to have a part in. You know, I still hold out hope. There's hope for you guys, maybe. If you work really hard and are blessed and take steroids and, you know, there's hope for you. But most of us, that ship has sailed. You know, and we like to kind of judge a situation that we cannot ever have. And so we look at, you know, either whether it's pool holes or whether it's, you know, the NFL players, and we say, you guys are greedy. You guys are asking for too much money, and we judge them. We judge their motives, their character, without really ever knowing them, without, you know, just kind of sitting on the sideline, a situation we can never experience. You know, if we were in the same situation, how would we react? We don't know. But it doesn't, that distance from the situation doesn't stop us from having an opinion. You know, it doesn't stop us from, you know, most of you raising your hands. I forgot to ask how many of you don't care. I guess if you want to raise your hand for that, yeah. You can sit this intro out then. You know, there's it's just, we don't have to be close to the situation in order to form a judgment. We don't have to really know the individuals in order to just quickly in our mind say, oh, well, that person's wrong. Oh, that person's right. You know, and we can really create judgments based on kind of a system of morality that we have in our head. We've got this system that you know, you plug an input in and we get an output. It's already just kind of built in. We don't have to think about it. Most of you didn't have to really sit down and think, you know, it just is more instinctual. You know, I just instinctively say, oh, well, this is wrong because of this. You already know why, because you have this system, this grid that you filter all these decisions through and out comes out of judgment. And it's just real natural. It's just part of being human. It's just something we do. It's just instinctual to us. And so there's a group in the Bible that really illustrates this judgment theme. Quickly casting judgment, building a system to filter things through in order to determine, you know, who's right and who's wrong and who's justified and who's defiled, who's righteous, who are the bad people, who are the good people. And they're called the Pharisees. And that's who we're going to be looking at today later on in the passage. In Mark, we'll be looking at the Pharisees. And the Pharisees are going to they're going to be questioning Jesus. But I want to remind you, because we haven't dealt with the Pharisees in a while. I mean, it's been a few chapters. It hasn't been since chapter 3. The beginning of chapter 3 is the last time we saw the Pharisees. And so I want to just briefly remind you who these people are. As Mark is building this story, he's using, you know, real people. The Pharisees were real people and they lived, but Mark is using them as a character and he introduces them to us and he tells us a little bit about them. And then they go away for about three or four chapters, and then they pop back up. And that's what we're going to look at today. So the Pharisees, the last time we met them was in Mark 3, 1 through 6, where Jesus is going to heal somebody on the Sabbath, the Jewish holy day. Like we meet today on Sunday, Jews meet on a Saturday. And this is the, you know, the end of the week, the day everyone's supposed to come together. And God told them a long time ago, said, you need to honor the Sabbath and make it holy. And so the Jews, with their systems of morality and wanting to build a grid around what does it mean to honor the Sabbath, they said, you can do nothing. No work, nothing. You need to just sit and think and meditate about God. And they actually have like a list of how many steps you can take and you know how much work you can actually produce from yourself, how much work can you require other people to produce. You know, a lot of Jews today that are really, you know, strict with these laws that you know date back a long time ago, they won't cook. No cooking. They'll do all their meals on Friday so they don't have to cook in order to obey these laws. And so we see the Pharisees, they come to Jesus and they're watching him, and Jesus knows they're there, and he says, I'm going to heal this man on the Sabbath. But they are opposed to that. How can he heal someone on the Sabbath? Doesn't he know the tradition? Doesn't he know that you're supposed to do no work on the Sabbath? And Jesus is like, look what you're doing. You know, I'm sitting here saying I'm going to heal a man, and you are upset it's on a certain day? And don't you think doing God's work of healing people would be a good thing to do, a holy thing to do on the holy day? And so we see this conflict very early on in Mark's gospel, where the religious leaders are upset that Jesus is not paying attention to their traditions. He's going against their traditions, knowingly going. I mean, it's not like he didn't know. I mean, this was something that would have been well known. He knew he was violating the religious leaders' tradition of how to keep the Sabbath holy. And his point is like, look, I'm healing somebody. I'm doing something that is good. I'm doing something that is righteous, and you're going to call it unrighteous. You're going to call it wrong. You know, how can you do that? But we see in towards the end, verse 5, that it says that they hardened their hearts. They would not listen to Jesus' explanation. They did not care that what he was doing was good. All they cared about was, this is the system, and we are so convinced that this is the right way to live, that if you're outside of this, then you're outside of God's will. You're outside of being righteous. You are defiled. You are something that you're just doing everything wrong. You have to be a part of this system. And they were hardened in their heart. They wouldn't listen. And there's just willful opposition to what Jesus was telling them, to the point that it ends this little section in verse 6, the end of this little section that I'm describing. The Pharisees say they were plotting to destroy him. So Mark throws out this, okay, the Pharisees are plotting to destroy him, and then he goes on three chapters where we don't even hear about him. And then that leads us to this next chapter. So when we read about the Pharisees, we need to remember the last confrontation that they just had, where Jesus is doing something that's breaking their tradition, and now they are plotting to destroy him. They want him out of there. And so this is the character that Mark is showing us of the Pharisees. This is who they are. This is what they were doing. And you know, we do a lot of the same things. You know, in fact, most of us, when we read this passage, we never want to ask the question, how am I a Pharisee? How does this Pharisaism, how does that represent me? Most of us like to ask, well, how am I the disciples? You know, I want to be one of the good guys, you know, or how do I represent, you know, or how does the man who was healed and believed in Jesus, how does that represent me? You know, and we like to assign ourselves to those characters, but the tough question and probably the better question is, how do I commit the same sin the Pharisees commit? How am I a Pharisee? How am I someone who builds this system in my head, and I know this system's going to be right and wrong, and I'm going to be fixed in that, even to the point where the gospel shows me something different. And I see the gospel kind of pushing my system out of the way, saying, no, there's a better way to look at things. But no, I want to keep my system. I want to quickly judge people. I see an input, and I'm saying, okay, nope, that's wrong. Or I see someone else do something, say, oh, nope, that's okay. Just instinctually, I want my system, because my system is typically going to be favoring me, right? Most of us don't have a system of morality, this grid that we are going to decide what is good and what is bad that disfavors you. You're not going to say, well, I struggle with lying, so lying's going to be the worst sin that I can think of. Most of you will probably say, well, I struggle with lying, but I'm really, really good at being generous. So I'm going to really value being generous. Being generous is the number one thing you can do, and being greedy is just the worst thing possible. I mean, you can't get lower than that. It's lying, well, you know, that's... it's just a white lie. It's not a big deal. And that's how we will build these systems, where we kind of, well, there's these sins I struggle with, but I'm going to push them to the back, and I'm going to focus on the sins I'm really good at not doing. The things I'm really good at. That's what's real. That's what's important. That's how I'm going to judge everybody else. If someone struggles with lying and they give, well, they're cool with me. If someone is really good at not lying, but they struggle with being greedy, well, then that person's evil. And then that person's looking at us saying, well, you're evil, you're greedy. And so we definitely push our sins that we struggle with the most to the side. And in our system, we kind of rationalize, oh, that sin doesn't matter. This is what's important. A lot of you will not only just look at you know, systems of sin, you know, struggling with certain sins, but you'll look at systems of thought. You know, you see this is the perfect example is in politics. You know, you've got your lefty tree hugger, you know, driving a Prius or whatever hybrid, you know, and, you know, can't get up past 60 miles an hour, and I'm stuck behind him driving in my lane saying, dude, just buy a better car so you can drive faster because I need to get where I'm going. And then he's looking at me saying, you know, you with your SUV, you know, and your Suburban burning up all my gas, you know, killing my children in the future, and, you know, that type of thing. And then some of you just, you know, could care less about the politics, and so you say, well, the whole political active thing, you know, that's wasting your life, that's stupid, that's, I'm going to judge everyone for being, you know, if you're political, that's just ridiculous. A lot of us have this in our background, Catholics and Baptists. That's kind of the, you know, overarching background for a lot of people in this church. My background is Baptist. You know, we have done some goofy things in the past. I've heard a story from a lady who was just a waiter, and I was having having a conversation with her, and she said, "Yeah, I used to go to church, but I was going to the Southern Baptist Church in Texas, and I was working at Applebee's, and they wouldn't let me come to church because I was serving alcohol." And she wasn't even drinking alcohol, but the fact that she was working at a restaurant that served alcohol, this group of people said, "You are so defiled. You are so wrong that you can't even hear the gospel. We're not even going to present the gospel to you." You know, I'm not as familiar with Catholics, but I know there is a lot of rules. I know there's a lot of structure in place that if you sin, you need to say this amount of prayers. You know, you need to give this much money. You need to do X in order to cancel out Y. This is, you know, and then they've got this system worked out for you. And if you don't follow that system, well, you're in error. Your sin still remains. And then there's something, you know, there's something you need to do in order to cancel that out. And so when we look at this, there is a real sense in where we should be asking, how am I a Pharisee? Because I see in my life and in my background, I see elements of judgment and elements of a structure that is not the gospel, but is of my own thinking and my own rationale of how life should be lived. And how should we judge people? And I see that in my life. And I see that in my background. So with that said, let us turn to Mark 7, 1 through 23, page 719. And again, remembering the Pharisees, they're plotting to kill or destroy Jesus in this gospel. They said they want to destroy him. Okay, so they are not cool with Jesus. They are not liking where he is going. And Jesus says, you know, he's just breaking their traditions. And so the Pharisees, in chapter 1, verse 7, okay, I just mixed that up. Chapter 7, verse 1 says, "Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem." Now, let me paint you a little picture for the geography. Where they're at, up around the Sea of Galilee, Jerusalem is like 80 miles away. So this might explain why they haven't been around, okay? Because they didn't have cars, they didn't have your Prius or your SUV or whichever you're driving. They had camel, okay? And camel was the popular mode of transportation. And I don't know how fast a camel horsepower, you know, camel power, I don't know what that is. But it probably took a while for them to get there. This is not an easy trip. And what I think is happening is the Pharisees who were upset about him healing a man on the Sabbath had to travel to Jerusalem, report it to the bigwigs, and say, "Hey, you've got to check this guy out up at the Sea of Galilee. He's doing a bunch of things, disregarding all of our traditions." And so these bigwigs from Jerusalem, which is like the big capital for the Jews, and I probably didn't explain that, but he comes and says, "Hey, you guys need to come check this out. This guy is disregarding all of our traditions, and he's showing no regard, and he's leading people astray. We need to go hunt this guy down." And so you see this group of Pharisees, after he's out healing people, going from town to town, all these people are coming to him. The people of the land are just coming to him and saying, "Look, I've got someone sick. Can you heal him?" And so, boom, healed. And he's going from town to town doing that. But when the Pharisees come, they're not so much excited about the miraculous power. They're plotting to destroy him. And they bring these Pharisees from Jerusalem. And they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. Now, most of us would say that's pretty gross. But the truth is, it's not they weren't like dirty hands, like they didn't wash at all, like, you know, like your Taco Bell guy who serves you food isn't washing his hands when he comes back from the bathroom. It's not that type of thing. That's disgusting. They're washing their hands before they eat. They're just not doing a ceremony. There's a specific ceremony that the Pharisees had in place that they wanted they wanted everybody to do in order to be good, but especially the disciples of a man who's gaining so much power. Oh, they've got to be doing these ceremonies. They've got to be, you know, I don't even know how it was. There's different theories on it, but one of it's that you clench your fist and you take water and you wash up to the elbow. And, you know, they're just like, oh, you've got to do these ceremonies. You have to become ritually, ceremonially clean before you can eat. And so they're upset about that. Now, Mark's going to give us a little background information. You see, we got a parenthetical statement. Parentheses at verse 3, it says, "For the Pharisees and all the Jews did not eat unless they washed their hands, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots, copper vessels, dining couches." And this is kind of Mark saying, you know, he's informing us. I think he might be kind of poking fun at him, like, you know, these guys are crazy with how much washing they want to do. They want to wash every little thing and have these ceremonies for any little thing, you know, just to have a snack. You know, I'm hungry, I need a snack, I just want something to eat, and, you know, I got to go through this whole process. I got to wash everything I'm going to touch, and I have to do all these ceremonies. And the truth is, the Pharisees had built these traditions. They built these traditions and these ceremonies because they wanted people to be holy. They wanted the Jews to be righteous before God. They wanted to build these laws as a fence around God's law. Most of you have heard the Ten Commandments, you know, don't murder, don't steal, don't commit adultery. And they looked at these verses and they looked at these core laws and they said, you know what we need to do? We need to build laws around this to fence people in. Because if we don't build the parameters, then people could just run off. You know, they could run off and start working on the Sabbath, and they could, and who knows, maybe they could start finding a loophole to steal from somebody else. And if we don't build these fence laws, these people are going to find loopholes and find ways out of the pen and to sin, you know, and get away from the law. And so that was their intent, was to build these laws that would help people obey the law. And they knew if they obeyed the fence law, well, because, I mean, if you're washing pots and pans, well, you're probably doing pretty good on the big ones, you know. You're probably not murdering anybody. You're probably not stealing anything, you know, if you're really that serious about washing all this stuff. So they built these fence laws, and that was to keep people inside, keep people doing the law. Verse 5, "And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, 'Why do your disciples not walk according to the traditions of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?' And he said to them, 'Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.'" You guys have so overvalued your traditions that you would rather do a tradition than obey the law. Verse 8, "You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of man." And so what Jesus is saying, you think you've built this fence that's going to keep people into the law, keep people, give them an ability to obey this law that God has given you by keeping all these little fence laws that you have. And you think you've done that, but what you've really done is you've built a bridge. You've built all these laws so much that people have no access to the law, and if you try to obey the traditions, you're going to just bypass the law. You're going to go right over it. And Jesus is saying, you're holding to the tradition to the detriment of holding to God's command. And he said to them, verse 9, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and mother, and whoever reviles father and mother must surely die.'" Right? Right? Okay. Just want you guys to remember that verse. Probably not legal, but remember it. "For Moses said, 'Honor your father and mother.' But you say, 'If a man tells his father and mother, whatever you would gain from me is Corban, that is given to God, then you know no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down, and many such things you do. And he's basically telling them, you know, okay, you've got this system. There's a great law that says honor your father and mother. And it's in the commandments. You should honor your father and mother. And the disciples, or the Pharisees, they had built this tradition where if someone says, I am going to give my house as a gift to God, it doesn't mean they had to sell it and give the money to the church or give the money to the poor. It doesn't mean that. It just means that whatever they are going to declare, whatever object they declare as a gift to God can only be used for God's purposes, can only be used to do something that probably the Pharisees would decide, okay, if you're going to give this to a gift, we'll decide how to use it. And so this man who gives his house or maybe gives some money and says, you know, I'm going to use this house for the glory of God. It is a gift. It is Corbin. It is cut off from the rest of my personal life. It is now a gift. It is now the property of God. And the Pharisee said, you know, this guy who does this, what if his mother or father come into debt? What if his mother and father lose their house? And now he needs this house. He needs this property to take care of his family, which is honoring his mother and father, which is what he should be doing. And now, because he's going to hold to the tradition of man, he's going to break the commandment. And this is, and he says, you know, you guys do this all the time. I could list so many examples because you guys have built so many traditions that it's almost impossible for you to keep all these laws. You've built ways that are going to cause people to bypass the law and not drive them to it. So he has a conversation with him about what actually defiles a person. And he called to the people to him again and said to them, hear me, all of you, and understand there is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him. But the things that come out of a person is what defile him. And when he, talking about the heart, we'll find out later. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled, which is an awful translation. Literally, it means goes into the toilet. Goes out into the toilet is actually the literal way to translate that Greek. And what he's saying is, you know, these Pharisees, they're so concerned with what you put into your body, what you eat, but that has a place to go. It doesn't stay with you. It doesn't sit there. There is a place for defilement that you can leave it and walk away. And then that defilement doesn't stay with you. It's away. It's away from you. It goes away. And, you know, I will avoid, I have a 2-year-old, so I have so many stories for this, but I can't pick which one. You know, we've got a diaper genie. I guess I just picked one. We've got a diaper genie, which if some of you haven't some of you haven't, you know, come aware of this diaper genie thing. I don't know if that's, you know, was back, you know, 10 years ago, 15. I didn't know if they've always had these things, but this thing is amazing in that I can put a diaper in this compartment and flip it open like a spaceship. There's like this, you know, vacuum, you know, like, I don't know, and it just goes away and there's not really much of a smell. It contains it. It's great, you know, and I just throw a diaper in, boom, done. The problem with that, though, is at some point in time, I have to open that genie and take like this just mound of diapers, you know, and the problem is we are so lazy about it. We, like, you know, you kind of, usually it's just boom, boom, you know, just flipping it shut real quick. But then it starts to get a little harder to shut, you know. But you don't want to take it out, so you just kind of, there, and then it goes in there, okay. And then you get the next one, you put it in, and you're like, okay, shut, okay. And then, so this bag inside is like bursting at the seams. And so when you open the lid, like it doesn't just, you know, it would be nice if we were not lazy about it. We would, oh, it's full, like a normal person, let's just take it out. The problem is now I'm sitting here, I have to have one foot on the kickstop and my thigh trying to hold this diaper genie while I'm, you know, pulling this bag that does not want to come out because it is now just too wide to fit through this little chute that I'm trying to pull it through. And And then I get that just wave of just fresh, you know, is there. It's supposed to be my job to change it. So when I say we're lazy, I probably should clarify that I'm lazy, and then I pay for it. But that defilement, what everyone says, that is so disgusting. Why is Jesus talking about this? That defilement goes away. I throw it in the trash, never to see it again, until a week later when I have to change it again. But at some point in time, these babies will learn to take care of it themselves. And at some point in time, I will no longer have to deal with this defilement, unless I end up like Mike and have twins at the age of 40, 42 or 3 or whatever. I can't even think that old. Okay, so, but all that defilement, it goes away. You know, you can leave it. And Jesus is saying, why are you so concerned about what goes in your body? Because it's not like it's not going to stay with you. But where does your heart go? Your heart doesn't have a spot to just dump it. It doesn't have that. Your heart is here, and where is the defilement that comes from your heart? Where is it going to go? And he says in verse 20, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. Talking about the heart. For what from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All of these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. There's no dumping ground for the defilement, the wickedness, the evil that comes from our hearts. When we look through this list, you know, immediately a lot of us like to say, I don't struggle with that. I don't struggle with theft. I don't struggle with murder. I don't struggle with adultery. But the problem is, Jesus took all these words and said, it's about the heart. You know, we're talking in context of the heart. How can the heart murder? You know, that doesn't make sense. The heart doesn't murder. How does the heart steal? Well, the heart doesn't steal. The heart desires for murder or ill will towards another person. The heart desires for theft. The heart covets it. The heart desires for adultery. And so we're in context of the heart. This is not an easy, you know, oh, I don't struggle with those things. I do have things I struggle with, but I don't struggle with those things. So I'm going to focus on these things that Jesus said. I'm not going to have evil thoughts. Well, that's probably a little harder one. But you know what? I'm not going to be sexual immoral. I'm not going to have steal stuff. I'm not going to kill people. You know, I'm not going to slander people. And I'll just try not to be an idiot. So I will do all these things that Jesus says to do. And yeah, I struggle with some of the heart stuff. You know, the heart, you know, my heart does desire for an individual to just not be here anymore. You know, my heart does struggle with, you know, seeing a girl that's not my wife. Hey, you know, like my heart struggles with stuff like that. What do I do? Well, I'm good at this stuff. That's not a big deal. That's just not a big deal. And so that's kind of how we tend to rationalize it, but Jesus is not letting us off the hook because this is in the conversation of the heart. Your heart does these things and has desires for these things and leads you to, even if you don't commit them, you think about them. At the very least, none of us can escape that. Some of you might be able to run through this checklist and say, well, I have never done these things, but has your heart done them? Does that evil come out of the heart? And so what we see is in the Pharisees they've taken this law and they've turned it into a system. Jesus is saying, dude, it's not a system, it's about the heart. Pharisees are saying, no, I want to create this system and so I can have checklists and I can make it really easy for me. I just want to not you know, I won't have any defilement. And the Pharisees, you see, they're this system of morality, but But the problem is what the system of morality does is it perverts God's law. It perverts what God told us to do, and it changes it, and it produces something that was never intended. What we see, it produces three things. It produces pride for the one who achieves it. Man, if I can follow this checklist, then I'm in. I'm good. I'm righteous. I'm not defiled. And so it gives me a sense of pride about what I have done, which the law was never intended, as we'll see in a second. It also gives hopelessness for the one who fails. There are going to be some laws. I mean, if you make a system of checklists and do's and don'ts, you might be fine with you know, just the do and don't part, but someone else might have a real struggle with it. Someone else might you know, and this probably isn't the time to get really into it, but you know, some people, there's the whole conversation about homosexuality. Am I born that way? You know, I don't have a problem with saying people are born with the tendency to do certain sins. You know, I was born to lust after women. This is a sin that I have. Someone else is born to lust after a man. Someone else is born to want to take every little thing they see and get away with. People have these sort of innate sins that they struggle with that will be a life struggle for the rest of their life. People have that. And so if you make a checklist about, well, you know, I am going to say homosexuality is worse than looking at porn. I'm going to make that worse because I know a lot of guys that struggle with this. Maybe I struggle with it myself. This is going to be not that big a deal. This is going to be a forgivable sin, but homosexuality, no, that's just, there's no reason to even come hear the gospel if that's what you are. And some of us will treat these sins like that when the truth is, they're on the same playing field. They're all evil that comes from the heart. And so we create these systems, and what does it produce? Hopelessness for the one who fails. If I make homosexuality a worse sin than something else I struggle with, then for someone who struggles and has a deep struggle with homosexuality, wants to love Jesus and is interested in hearing about Jesus, but they have a deep struggle. And if they see Christianity as a checklist, just, I need to not be gay. And that's a checklist. And then they just say, I can either do it or not do it, and I just need to make a checklist. Well, that's hopeless for them. How are they going to break out of that system? If it's just make it happen, it's hopeless. And the other thing it produces is a separation between the two. You've got these people that are prideful about the accomplishments they have done, and you've got these people that are hopeless because they can never fit perfectly into this checklist, and we just separate. No, don't come hear about the gospel. You're not good enough to hear the gospel. But what does Jesus do? Does Jesus condemn the Pharisees for judging, or does he condemn the Pharisees for judging based on a system of morality? When I read this passage, I don't see Jesus saying it's wrong for you to judge, because God did give a law. He did give a moral compass. He did give us something to say, this is what I expect. So is it wrong to judge at all? Or is it wrong to judge based on a moral system? Is it wrong to judge simply based on a checklist? And what I think Jesus is saying is, you guys have built this system, and it's your system that's wrong. You've missed the true purpose of the law. So the law is not only a system of morality, because it certainly is. I mean, how is it not? Do not murder. Well, that's a moral. So we see morality in the system. We see morality in the law of God, in the Bible. We see it telling us to do certain things that we would say, okay, well, that's a system of morality. Yeah, okay, I'm okay with that. It's a system of morality. But is that all it is? The Pharisees think that's all it is. But Jesus comes and says, no, you guys have missed it. I mean, that's like the basic, you know, yeah, it's a system of morality, but what else is it? I mean, what is it functioning as? Is it just a system of morality that's going to produce pride for the ones who keep it and hopelessness for the ones who miss it? Or is it not only a system of morality, but is it revealing the heart of God? Does it reveal to us who God is? We see in Exodus chapter 19, this is when God had brought the people out of Egypt. And he brings them out of Egypt. He saves them as a people, and he comes and says, look, I want to be your God. I want you to be my people. And I've brought you out of this land of slavery. I've done away with that. And now you are in relationship with me. If you're going to be in relationship with me, this is what I want you to do. This is how I want you to live in order to have a healthy relationship. See, and then he gives the Ten Commandments, chapter 19. We'll go ahead and read it. While Moses went up to God, the Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and to the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples." He's saying, I want to be in a relationship with you. Now he's going to give them the law. He says, do this, but it's not just to keep a checklist. It's not just to build yourself into, oh, look what I have achieved. It's because he wants to be in a relationship. It shows us the heart of God. It shows us who he is and his values and just his person. Secondly, we see that the law is not only a system of morality, but it is revealing all of humanity's sin. Romans 7:7 through 10 shows us, what then shall we say? That the law is sin? By no means. Yet if it had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. For I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin sees an opportunity through the commandment produced in me all kinds of covetousness. For apart from the law, sin lies dead. I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin came alive and I died. The very commandment that promised life proved to be death to me. He says, I can't keep this commandment. You know, the law came and I wanted to keep it. I tried to keep it, but I can't keep it. I keep sinning. I keep doing something that is defiling me. I cannot. So the law is not given so people can achieve and then separate themselves from those who are just not up to snuff. But the law shows that all of us don't have it. All of us are not up to snuff. All of us struggle with different aspects of trying to be like God. All of us struggle deeply with that. There's something in us that we just cannot do the law perfect. We cannot live as Jesus. We cannot live as God would have us live. And lastly, we see that the law separating humanity from God. The law shows us our sin, but then it shows us that because we sin and God's perfect, that there's a division. When we sin, we are breaking this covenant between us and God, this relationship. We are pushing God away by our sin. And so that's what the true intent of the law was, not to build these classes of people, you know, the righteous and the defiled, but to show that all people are defiled, and God alone is righteous. Now, for some of you who come out of a Catholic or just a real strict background, even my Baptist background, there were strict rules. They weren't like written out, but you know, we come from this and we hear this and we think, yes, no more checklist. But then we're like, oh wait, this is still not a good option. I'm still in my sin. I'm still having no way out. I'm stuck in my sin because if I can't, keeping the law would have been easier than making my heart right. How can I control just instinctual thoughts that come in my head? How can I can try to manipulate it. I can try to put myself in situations that aren't there, but deep down inside, I know I'm struggling with certain sins, with the desires for certain sins. How do I fix my heart? And the truth of the law is that it is coming to show us that all of humanity is in a desperate state of defilement. But Jesus doesn't leave us there. The law would just leave us there. If that's all we had was the law, we would be left in a hopeless, helpless situation. But Jesus comes and says, I have come to restore the most defiled of sinners. Did you guys get the map? Is there a map on there? Oh, wow, look at that, it's beautiful. I was really worried that wouldn't come through. Okay, so to give you an idea of, because this section that we have just been looking at is an introduction to the next chapter or two. What's called the Gentile mission. We're going to see Jesus go to the Gentiles. Now, think of this. He is having a conversation with the Pharisees and telling them what true defilement is. True defilement is not keeping the law and not living the Jewish system of life. But true defilement comes from the heart. You can be in the Jewish system or you can be outside the Jewish system and still be defiled because of your heart. And to emphasize the point, I think Mark is purposely putting this together. To emphasize the point, we see that Mark, after this conversation, earlier on, he wanted to go to Bethsaida. Right there. But he's over here. Well, it's like, I don't know, 6-8 miles. Day's trip. You know, it's certainly not the 80 miles from Jerusalem. You know, I mean, this is just a day trip. It's no big deal. And so Jesus said, hey, this is when he walked on the water last time. He said, hey, why don't you guys go on the boat? We're going to go to Bethsaida. It'll be a fun trip. And he's right here. And then he has this conversation with the Pharisees. And the Pharisees, I'm not sure how much emphasis to put on this, but what do we see Jesus do? Well, I can tell you this. He doesn't go there. He goes up here to Tyre. I don't know. That's like, what, a 50-mile trip, 80-mile trip. Then he goes to Sidon. And then from Sidon, he takes this long loop to come to the Decapolis, this big region here. And he basically walks an entire circle around Bethsaida. And a lot of people think when he got to the Decapolis, he actually took another boat ride here and then came over there. So when he was walking on water, he said, I want to go to Bethsaida because that's where the Jews are and I want to tell them about the gospel. And then he has this conversation with the Pharisees about defilement. You got to understand, the Pharisees think anyone who's not a Jew is completely defiled and just disgusting. And the only thing worse than a non-Jew is a half-breed with a Jew and what's called a Samaritan, a Jew and a Gentile. And they just do not like these people. They are what defilement is. And Jesus shows them, you know what? You guys think you know what defilement is, but I'm going to show you that true defilement, what you think is truly defiled, being outside the Jewish system, these Gentiles, these pagans, these people from all these other countries, you think they're really defiled? I'm going to go present them the gospel. Because the law doesn't just stop. The Bible doesn't just stop. The story doesn't stop with, here's the law, make the checklist, live it. The story goes on from there to, you can't live it, Jesus did. Jesus lived it for you. He lived it for the Jews, but then he went to the Gentiles. That is us. That is us who the Jewish system would have disregarded. Jesus says, no, you are not defiled because of this system. You're defiled because of your heart. But I came to change your heart. I came to live the life that you could not live, and then to bring you the Spirit that would work inside your life and change your heart and get you to love God and to want to follow God. And Jesus says, based on my life and my death and my resurrection, you are not defiled. And that's where the story leads us. And that's where this section is going to go for the next few sermons, is Jesus is going to go into the Gentiles and say, you are not disadvantaged because of your non-Jewishness. You can become a part of the people of God. And I am here to live and love and die for you. And that is what we see as this message, where we look at it and say, well, the heart, that's a tough thing to do. But Jesus is our Savior. Jesus is the one that we look to. We don't look to a system. We don't look to achievements that we have done. We look to Jesus because he's the only person who has ever perfectly fulfilled and loved God through this life. And it is on his work that we can now come to God and worship and praise and call God our Father. And so as we bow our heads and pray to God, let's go into a time of worship where we thank God for what Jesus has done for us. Lord, we come to you and thank you for everything that you have done. Sending your son for defiled people like us because of our hearts. Lord, I pray that you will help us to move away from the systems that we justify ourselves. Move away from trying to become righteous in and of our own work, and turn to Jesus as the Savior of this world. In Jesus' name, amen.